Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, the speaker is Roland James. Today he will be speaking on the sports culture and the culture of violence. So let's listen in on Roland James.
I've written a number of columns on sports and culture and in the current issue of this paper, wrote one on the sports culture, the culture of violence, bringing in O.J. Simpson a little bit and Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman, and not trying to prejudge that murder case in any way, but Mr. Simpson was convicted of spousal abuse in 1989, and the reaction of the sports world to that was, there wasn't any reaction. He went on being who he was. He was rehired by NBC. He was rehired by Hertz. None of his friends, and he has many, I guess, seem to have counseled him or kind of warned him about the situation he was in. Of course, the legal system also kind of just slapped him on his on the wrist, and so I think some of this stuff is pretty disturbing to me. Anyway, I grew up playing sports, running track and field. I played high school football, and even in high school football, there was. Well, if you wanted to put down someone, generally you play like a wuss, or you play like a woman, oftentimes they were related to gender put downs, and locker room banter is replete with put downs of women, even in high school. Joe Paterno, after a loss in this article, I point out that he said, he was going to go home and beat his wife. And somebody called him on it later, and he said, kind of in defense of the remark, he just kind of shrugged it off and said it was just a harmless joke, part of the sports culture. Unfortunately, I think it's become much more than a harmless joke. On Super Bowl Sunday in 1993, some people wanted to see NBC run a public service announcement with regard to spousal abuse, because Super Bowl Sunday is supposedly the leading day for that in the country. The Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal took out after these people who wanted the public service announcement, and the Washington Post attacked those seeking the public service announcement as causes who show up wherever the most TV lenses are, and other media were equally as contemptuous. This paper is kind of an attempt, I think, to do what Holden tries to do, and that is kind of develop our own institutions, our own outlets, our own forms of communication, no one that writes for this paper is paid. But it's distributed, there are about 20,000 copies. It's distributed at public libraries and post offices in the Phoenix area. I think I'll attempt to take home to Phoenix also the idea of perhaps a combination bookstore restaurant, and maybe we can start that in Phoenix also. But sports also is an area where, instead of watching professional teams on television or in person, you can play yourself. You don't have to depend upon the mass culture for sports. Professional sports and big time college sports are essentially a diversion, kind of like the Roman circuses of old. And they're to divert you, to keep your mind off of what I consider to be kind of the more important things, like playing ball with your child. During the playoffs, Little League games are still conducted in Phoenix. Many times there aren't many parents there. Sometimes some of the coaches don't show up. They'd rather stay home and watch the Phoenix Suns on television. I think that's a real indictment of our society. This spectacle has replaced politics. And that's also happening in other countries, but I don't think to as great a degree. Carmen, who's part of the musical team here and just conducted a class on folk music, Latin America, is from Brazil. And she said, well, Brazil has won the World Cup, but that means that the establishment party will win the next election. Because the people will feel good about that, and it's kind of an opium, an addiction, and therefore they won't pay that much attention to the coming election. And despite the fact that, according to her, 40 million of Brazil's 130 million people are on the verge of starvation, the country has massive problems. Sport has become such an opium, or such an addiction, or such a spectacle, that it's replaced politics in the true sense of that word. The Greek word polis means city, and polis referred to the economic, social, even the private religious patterns and habits and customs of the people. Everything that goes on in the city is related to that word, polis, and that's where we get the word politics. So when I talk about politics, I'm not talking about Republican versus Democrat. I'm talking about it in the Greek sense of that word.
You know, if I can interject just briefly with the World Cup, which Brazil did win it.
Right.
Interesting.
Carmen was listening on the radio, so she's a little bit addicted too.
But anyway, one thing that really struck me as I was watching some of the programs on TV, when Brazil was playing, whenever a goal would be played or a great save made or something like that, they would show the big square in Sao Paulo, where there was something like a million people there watching a big screen in the big city, you know, cheering their team on. And one thing that really struck me is that this is a way in which these countries can have international acclaim. I mean, it's you can see how the people really rally behind their athletes, because they have no other way in which they can, you know, beat the United States or, you know, the Western European powers and things like that. But in this way, in their sports, they can get worldwide acclaim. And that just really struck me, just an aside.
Yeah, and I don't mean to put down Brazil or other countries.
No, I know.
It's much more of a problem, as I see it, in this country. Professional sports and sports that spectator sports have essentially become a diversion, and kind of a childish diversion. And when Paul talks about giving up childish things, I think spectator sports might be, I'm not talking about participatory sports, talking about spectator sports, might be one of those things that perhaps we should give up.
The way in which our society idolized O.J. Simpson, and then the reaction to the situation he was in, the emotional reaction that people have had. You know, he's just a person, just a regular person.
Right.
Sports idol that people have had very emotional reactions. You know, they can't possibly believe that he, and they don't know him. You know, but still they think they know him.
Yeah, the confusion of celebrity with heroism. There are sports characters, figures that are actually heroes. Jackie Robinson, who showed a great deal of courage in being the first black in professional baseball. And that courage kind of shined through off the field too. Arthur Ashe, who a few months before he died participated in a public demonstration where he was arrested at the U.S. Embassy in protest of our policy towards Haiti, and who would not be involved in any tennis youth program unless it taught fundamental values. He wasn't so much concerned about the young people learning how to be good tennis players or eventually playing at Wimbledon, but he was very concerned about teaching fundamental values. Roberto Clemente happened to get his 3,000th hit on the last day of, I can't remember which year now, so 71, 72, or 73. And that winter, flying relief supplies to Nicaragua, which he had paid for himself, he had paid for the plane, died when the plane went down. Even Bill Bradley, a U.S. senator, has been able to see that there are things beyond the arena that are actually more important than the arena. But these people are not the ones that are held up in our media as people to have as heroes. So O.J. Simpson had as his hero as a young person Willie Mays, and not because Willie Mays was a good baseball player, but because he had a big house. And that's perhaps understandable for a kid from the ghetto. But O.J. didn't change when he became adult. There's no indication that he matured with regards to this materialistic attitude. He spent essentially all his time, free time on the golf course, rubbing elbows with his other wealthy friends. Not much commitment to the community that he left, that I can see. Maybe I'm being too harsh. Maybe he did things that I don't know about, but very much a concern about accumulation of wealth, which is kind of the American dream, the American ideal, but I don't think it's terribly heroic. Yeah.
I guess I see that, isn't it true of all, we include all of those that we're holding up as, stars and that, they all fall in that same category, nearly, and I guess in some ways...
That wasn't true, though, 20 years ago.
Today, that is the case, and I guess I know that there aren't many black people here, but I think that a number of people that are black would be offended by, this zeroing in. There has been a lot of zeroing in on O.J., and I'm just wondering whether or not the zeroing in, it wouldn't have taken place if it was someone else of a white complexion. And I've seen that this is the typical type of thing we're finding in the people that are our heroes today. They're only concerned about themselves and how many additional millions of dollars they get, and and their life on drugs and things, steroids. And I guess that's just a view I have, that it wouldn't have taken place if it was a white man.
Well, I think it would have taken place probably, but less to a less fervent extent.
Maybe so.
It's been interesting in the media, they have talked quite a bit about the black community's reaction versus the white community's reaction to the OJ thing. And it's been very interesting for me to read and try to understand the blacks' perspective. One of the things is that I've actually read that he's been criticized by some of the black community for not having any blacks on his defense team. All of the lawyers are wealthy white lawyers, and they have seen that as a sellout of their race. A faction that I've read about, another faction of the Newsweek polls and things have said that they've asked whites versus blacks, men versus women, whether they think you can get a fair trial, whether they think you really did it, you know, things like that. Very different responses. I wish I could quote the percentages, but basically white people feel that he probably can get a fair trial, and black people say no way. It's very interesting the way that the justice system, the society, I mean, I think that speaks a much broader thing about how society
I don't
want
to get too much into the OJ upcoming trial.
But,
I mean,
but I was just thinking those things.
Yeah, I think whether he's innocent or guilty, there's still enough stuff there from the past before this murder, double murder, that we can talk about that without really talking about the double murder. And
I think we can look at something more basic and part of our communities to illustrate some of the points that you're making, and that is like youth sports. I officiate soccer, and my children play. My wife's a soccer mom. But I think in a way sports reflects our society. You see everything, you see the good, the bad, and the ugly, again, just like with anything else. But I'm kind of amazed as a sports official because soccer is becoming more violent. You've seen in the World Cup where the referees have had to tighten up. And at a local community level where you see a sport, and I think some generalizations could be made to other sports, but you see a wide range. You see in the very young level of the sport, a great amount of dedication. You see the little kids running around, parents in small-sided games, you know, four kids, and it's just fun. It is wonderful. But even at that level, you get an anger and a competitiveness that, you know, I don't know if I've come to the conclusion about how you sort all this out, but certainly as you get older then, what happens is you start to see more violence. Not necessarily maybe fighting, but anger. And you sort of like the Greek idea of sports somehow is getting lost here. Right? I have a theory about it, and that is that our society does not allow enough outlets for physicalness, particularly for males. I think males have more of that, but I mean, it's everyone. And sports are a way that people can express that. Whether it's, I get a lot of things.
Spectators?
Well, yeah. You know, anger at an official, anger at people. And I've been in situations with my son's team where it was actually a fist fight on the field with parents and everybody swinging. You know, it's just, you go home and you say, there's something really wrong here. You know, something has gone over the edge. And the anger you see on the sidelines. And I don't have an answer for all this, but I'm just saying that it's a reflection to me of society, of things that we don't have outlets, it's repressed, and it has to come out. And I don't know where I'm going with this, but I'm just making some observations that I see it, especially as an official. I have to deal with it, but sometimes I can't deal with it because as we're taught as officials, the first responsibility is the player themselves. If they don't come from an environment where they've gotten some training, education, they can't control it. And then it's the coach, and a lot of times the coach are part of the problem, you know. Because the parents, you know, I mean, they're there, the coach has to deal with that. But a lot of times, no one is dealing with it.
Well, I would go a little bit deeper than that even, maybe, but I appreciate what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. Professional sports have become a part of our culture to such an extent that about the only kind of facility that you can pass a tax bond election for in some of our major cities is a professional sports team. In Phoenix, they want to spend $250 million of taxpayer money to build a baseball stadium at the same time that they're paying players, you know, several million dollars a year, and the owners are making lots of money. And then they want to hire people from the inner city at $5 or $6 an hour to take care of the place. So sports kind of, I think, has helped create or helped exacerbate the gap between rich and poor in the United States. Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan advertised Nike shoes. Now, there are no Nike shoes or Reebok shoes made in the United States anymore. They're generally made by people in Indonesia or China, Southeast Asia for 15 cents an hour. And then they pitch these on television and they direct them to inner city kids who can't afford them. So you've actually had shootings over a $150 pair of Nikes in our inner cities. This kind of materialism, it's wrapped up in materialism as well as violence. And all through the society, not just on the playing field where people get angry, and I think that's kind of a normal response. It's just that once it gets beyond a certain point, I think it becomes dangerous, but that's kind of a human thing. People will get wrapped up in a game, and I don't really see much of a problem with that. I'm more concerned with how this spreads through the society.
Except, you know, as you can analyze the situation forever, and I'm sure you've, you know, moved on to thinking, well, then what do we do about it? And to me, one of the ways you do something about it as a parent or as an individual is at the sidelines of the game, you know, interacting with coaches or referees or being a coach or referee yourself, trying to get that message to young people that winning is not the end-all and the be-all, that the way you play the game, the sportsmanship, and the way you carry that into your life is the more important thing. And we adulate winning so much that it's winning at all costs, be it drug use, be it violence. And that, to me, is kind of where it starts for me as an individual. And I would wonder, you know, could the church do anything for these star athletes in terms of saying, you know, let us help you think about it in a broader sense or something? I mean, if someone just presented to them the things about the Nikes and the Reeboks that you were bringing up. There's no forum to do that, though.
Well, I think most of them know this. It's been pretty widely...
I doubt that they really think about it much.
That's the point, I think. That even Kevin Johnson, who's a guard for the Phoenix Suns, is pretty involved in the community. He set up a youth center in Sacramento, his hometown. He says he's a Christian and seems to have he's kind of a feisty guy on the court sometimes, but he seems to have a pretty good demeanor about him. But on the broader issues, he's pretty silent. You know, he's willing to pray with A.C. Green, who's another rather devout Christian, and some of the other players before a game. But I don't see much concern about the overall societal issues. And this is one of them. Jim Oines in this article, if you don't have these I call passing a test of faith over there in the last column, he talks about what was really the issue. Jesus asked, who is our neighbor? And then he told the story of the Good Samaritan. And the answer, of course, is that anyone who is in need is our neighbor. Sports, oil, the media, the government is only one part of that. There are so many different things in our society that pull us away from being faithful to things that really matter. And then he goes on to talk about Game 6 when Phoenix lost the playoffs or lost the NBA championship to Chicago. On Game 6 Sunday, the day the Suns lost to the Bulls, I bet 90% of the ministers in town That was a Sunday afternoon. So on that Sunday morning, I'll bet 90% of the ministers in town used a sports metaphor in their sermons. That same weekend, a Central American woman died trying to enter the United States by trekking across the Sonoran Desert. Which was more important, the Suns game or the woman who died in the desert? The poor are the best monitor for society. If you are not in touch with the poor and the needy, then you are not in touch with reality. And I think this has become more and more the case in an article that I wrote back in June of 93, kind of taking off on something that Charles Barkley said. I don't know, I suppose this was all over the country about he wasn't a role model and he wished that people would get their priorities straight. Well, we could start perhaps by having a tax policy in this country that says no employer could deduct more than $200,000 in compensation for any employee. Maybe then we could start to get a priority straight. If you want to pay somebody $10 million, fine. But you're going to have to pay it. You're not going to get the rest of the society to subsidize the salary. I mean, there's fairly simple answers. These are things that other societies have done, the Europeans, and these are not anything really revolutionary. In this country, we think it's perfectly fine now to pay people thousands of times more than an ordinary worker gets. And this leads to a certain sense of hopelessness, because only so many people can do these things, be CEOs of companies or sports figures. When I was growing up, athletes weren't paid nearly as much as they are now. They only made maybe two or three times as much as an ordinary worker, and they regularly rubbed shoulders and elbows with ordinary people. And kids in Chicago in the 1950s could go to the stadium and get in for a quarter and sit out in the outfield stands. And the high school basketball team was much bigger than the professional team from Chicago in the central part of Illinois where I grew up in part of my youth. But that changed. I mean, when Steve Carlton wanted $65,000 in 1973 for the 1973 season. That's only 20 years ago or so. And Gussie Bush, the owner of the St. Louis Cardinals, said, "You're not worth it. I'm still going to pay you $55,000, what you earned last year." So he traded him to the Philadelphia Phillies. He was the best pitcher, perhaps, of the last 30 years. This last winter, Jack McDowell, who many of you maybe not don't even recognize his name, he's a pitcher for the Chicago White Sox, wanted $6.5 million, or 100 times as much. And I think that's not a good thing. And sports are only one example of this. Barbara Streisand, I think we had our own Barbara Streisand here at Holden when Mary Preuss was here. But she's never going to be a commercial success like Barbara Streisand, perhaps, because she doesn't sing that kind of music. Yeah. But developing your own community, your own talents in the area of music and sports, I think is the way to do it. And not being so wrapped up in the success of the local professional team. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have professional sports. I just wish it wasn't such a... I guess I wish it was like it was when I was growing up. And I kind of go through that in this column I wrote, Getting Our Priorities Straight. It seemed more honest and... not all the hype and all the dishonesty and even propaganda that we have in it now.
I wonder if you'd be willing to address the psychology of the violence that happens after the Super Bowl. I really don't understand that.
Well, I don't think anyone really does, and it's much of this evidence is anecdotal. No one's really been doing, good scientific studies of this yet, anyway, or at least we don't have the results yet. But watching a violent game, and football is the ultimate game of violence and domination. If you haven't played it and you just see it on television and you don't hear the sounds of the guys down on the field hitting each other, you should try to go to the sideline sometime while a college team is practicing. High school guys aren't quite big enough to get the big, but just the tremendous force of these guys who are 250 to, now they're up to 350 pounds going against each other. It just, it creates quite a noise.
That movie Rudy, if anybody hasn't seen that,
gives you a sense of that. So it's a violent game to play, but I think when you're watching it on television, you don't hear that noise, you just kind of see these collisions and the people kind of catapulting through the air. You're kind of removed from the more violent aspect, but I think it, especially if it's combined with drinking beer, and it often is, it leads to yelling at the television set to support your team, and eventually, if you've had too much beer and your team loses, or your team doesn't get a first down sometime during the game, you take it out on maybe your wife.
I like to suggest that even if your team wins.
Even if your team wins, it happens.
You feel an air of superiority, you have to act that on the house too.
The Canadians say that the National Hockey League is a violent kind of, and hockey is also a violent sport. I've never played hockey, but generally, I guess they have a lot of fights, and fights aren't really discouraged that much in hockey. You have a penalty box, I guess, if you fight too much, but...
Fights are encouraged.
Yeah.
The fans like that, but the CBC policy now is to go to commercial when there's a fight.
Oh, good.
But I live in Vancouver, and it's covered sometimes on two channels, so people prefer to watch the other one where they eat their own. But that is the CBC policy now.
Are all of these sports a metaphor for normal life where everybody wants to feel superior, they want to be number one? And the thing we hear most is, we're number one, we're number one. Those great big signs coming up, we're number one. And so it's the greed for power, the greed for success, the greed for wanting to be number one, that, and we identify with our heroes. So that sitting back, we can identify with our heroes. We can get our emotions up over our heroes and in the same way. And so you find fights in the stands. I don't know whether they fight in the stands when they're winning or when they're losing, and maybe it doesn't make any difference. They just get an emotional release, ready for this. But the metaphor here that bothers me is that then we carry this over for our country and war. We're going to be number one. We're going to beat down the other country. Or we're going to beat the little country like we have in Central America. We're going to kill off the people that get in our way when we want to be number one.
Well, that's part of the survival of the fittest mentality that, capitalism, that's what it is. And so that it just doesn't go into sports, but it goes into everything that we have that permeates our whole culture and our the American way. And
Yeah, and I guess the question is whether the church can say something that's distinctively Christian to that kind of society, or are we so much a part of it? And that some people say that much of Christianity in the United States is so much a part of the middle class and upper middle class society that we're not really saying anything distinctive or anything Christ-like or anything that, why have the church if it doesn't say something that is distinctively Christian?
Well, the church is to be prophetic. You know, I guess the thing is that people, we're so engrossed in our society and, you know, all these things like governmental, you know, religion of the state, you know, patriotism. Well, that has waned many different ways depending on the war, but we're so, that when the church would speak out against something, you know, it turns off a certain portion of the church. And, you know, like many people don't like the Lutheran itself, and they're trying to, I at least think some of the editors, the editor is trying to portray some differing kinds of faces over each other. And at least coming from our congregation, boy, they'd like to, you know, just get this Lutheran out of here. Where are they coming with some of these ideas? They're foreign. And I think that's probably a reaction. You know, we're trying to build up the church and we're going to be tearing people apart. I guess the thing is, we're united often for the wrong reasons.
And does that mean we can't be united for the right reasons?
No, but I'm saying it's going to cause more conflict. Yeah. You know, that's the thing. That's the sports is supposed to deflate some of this conflict between each other by portraying it out there, rather than bringing it at home to where we live.
But you know, there are churches that are just for peace. And I think of the Quaker movement, the Mennonites, and a few others like that, they are entirely for peace and against violence, and they practice that whole thing. And I know I said something in one of these sessions about, can't the church speak out? And he said, well, the church is the, no, because it's the local congregation that is the church, the people in the local congregation. And that we aren't supposed to speak out like that. And so that, well, if you read the Luther magazine, see all the letters when anybody speaks out against something, then there's a dozen letters that are against it. And it must be our Lutheran church, the way it's organized and so forth. And of course, the Catholic Church speaks out. They speak out against women being, and then there's a group of them, of course, that are against it. But I don't know how the church can stand up for these things that we speak out for that we don't like. That we don't like the violence. We don't like the salaries that these heroes get, for instance, and as you see, they're $5.
I call them celebrities. I wouldn't call them heroes.
So I just don't know what the answer is to the Lutheran Church, because we've talked about this a number of times, that we can't even agree about that. The Chilstrom wrote to the president about the war in against Iraq, against it, and the letters in the Lutheran that said he shouldn't have done it. He didn't speak for me.
Oh yeah, we certainly hear that in our church.
Well, I'd like to make a couple of comments about Norway and New Zealand. I don't know if any of you watched the Winter Olympics this past winter.
Oh yes.
But little Norway with 4 million people.
Oh God.
And they were almost ashamed of the fact that they won more medals than any other country. Norway, of course, is like most European societies. It has a very low crime rate. You don't find their professional heroes being paid large salaries. In fact, I think one of the guys who won a medal was going to give away most of his prize money to some cause or something. Kind of refreshing to see that. You can walk in the cities of Norway at 4 a.m. without fearing being mugged. Back in 1984, the United States was all puffed up because we won the most medals in the 1984 Olympics, Summer Olympics at Los Angeles. Of course, the Soviet Union wasn't there. Little New Zealand, if you count medals on a per capita basis, won, I think, six times as many medals as the United States. But, you know, and they're truly interested in people participating in running and in Olympic-type sports. But I don't think they overemphasize it. I don't think you saw a kind of a machine like they had in East Germany. New Zealand is you don't find that much social Darwinianism in New Zealand either. This whole issue of violent crime is real troublesome in the United States, and I don't know, most of us maybe don't care that much about this statistic, because many of these people are in the inner city that are killing each other. We just kind of put it out of mind. I think at the base of this is economic oppression and lack of economic opportunity. Many of the good jobs, and I admit that many of those are in defense industries, have left Los Angeles, so there aren't many good jobs in, for example, the central city of Los Angeles. So these kids are essentially without hope, and we're paying, you know, certain people in our society so much, but yet we can't find jobs at a dollar or two above minimum wage for many people.
Well, these kids are totally without role models too, especially the young men.
Yeah, and that's...
Sports heroes can become their role models.
Unfortunately, the role models become the O.J. Simpsons. And,
you know, it's interesting talking about the church making policy statements and then everybody getting riled up and, you know, disagreeing. Just sitting here reflecting on the whole ELCA, it was in the paper so much, the statement on sexuality, human sexuality. The amount of time and energy that went into that, the amount of debate and reworking it. And that is, of course, an issue that needs to be addressed in society today. But to my way of thinking, it's so much less an issue than something like the violence and the killing of young people. But yet we don't, and maybe it's that this is just too difficult or too big to know how to make a statement about it or how to make an impact.
Can I repeat what was said in another session the other day, that Jesus talks more about accumulation of wealth and the sin of accumulating wealth than he does about anything else. And when you stop and think of all of us, if someone started pointing the finger at me for what I am doing with my wealth instead of sharing it where there is real need, it's much easier for me to defend sexual lust or pretend I don't have sexual lust than it is for me to pretend that I don't have greed. And maybe if we would concentrate on this and work to diminish the idea that we're going to be number one in everything, we're going to have more wealth, we're going to have more power, we're going to have more esteem, maybe we could do something with our church.
Well, we have become such a materialistic society, so what you are earning your money for is to get material things, and like I say,
what you don't need.
Oftentimes, in Minnesota, everybody has to have that cabin up north, and they have to have that boat for fishing, and they, and two or three cars, especially when the kids become teenagers, they have to have their own car, and you go on down the list. And then our church struggles to even support some programs that are very worthwhile, but we just don't get the money to do it.
Well, in that same session, when I talked about what righteousness meant,
yes,
and in the Bible, I guess righteousness meant giving proportionately of your income, and you know, I think that really needs to be addressed so much
kinda,
more.
Kind of hits home, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does really, and then identifying who are the poor. Mm-hmm. The poorer people. What did they say? In two or three, were you there? Rolling that session.
I don't think I was. No.
Yeah, they said that anybody who lost their income for 6 months would really be destitute.
Yeah, and then
it is the poor.
Some of the people were saying, well, actually, in 2 or 3 months, I'd be on the street with no, if I had no income coming in. And then they were sick. And then, let's see, who led that session? Can't
Rich.
See his name.
Rich.
Rich.
Mark Rich.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he was saying that. Anyone who works is considered the poor. Well, in our society, I don't think that's true.
I don't know
either. Maybe in the biblical society. I mean, mm-hmm. people who had to work, that were slaves or, you know, by the sweat of their brow, they made their income. But now if we work, we can be awfully comfortable working.
I'd like to say a couple more things about violent crime. Jesus said, resist not evil, but overcome evil with good. And that kind of seems counterintuitive, but perhaps it even works in not just interpersonal relationships, but in public policy. The United States is the only industrial democracy with the death penalty, yet we are by far the leading murder nation of the world. The United States by far has the toughest drug laws of any industrial democracy, yet we have the most drug abuse. We incarcerate more people by far than any other society on a per capita basis, yet we have much more crime. So, perhaps he had something there. I tend to think that the Europeans and some of the other societies have actually kind of realized this, maybe not consciously, but that the more you fight against something sometimes, the more you get tough, the worse the problem's going to get. We've had get tough on crime legislation in Arizona for the last 15 years, every year, and every year the crime rate, or the crime seems to get worse, at least the violent crime and the crime from our young people seems to get just worse. But we seem to elect these people that pass these laws and
What are they doing in the European countries that prevent crime when they don't have those stringent laws?
Well, they're much more egalitarian now. This used to be different. They used to be much more class stratified and have much wider gaps in income in Europe than we did here. But over the last 30 years or so, they've become more egalitarian. And as I mentioned in the meditation yesterday at noon, the bottom 20% in the United States now earns about 4% of our national income. In Great Britain, what most of us think of as a class stratified country with a real class system, the bottom 20% there earns about 8%. Now, admittedly, in the United States, you can win the lottery or you can become a, you can go from a kid in the ghetto to a professional athlete and make millions. So you can move between classes fairly easy here, or move between income levels. We don't really have classes fairly easily here. You can become wealthy overnight here, but if you're at the bottom, you're not making it. And most people stay pretty much at the same level throughout their life. There's only a few that move. And we're approaching the Latin American countries in terms of the gap between rich and poor. As I mentioned, Brazil, the bottom 20% there earns about 1.5% of the Brazilian national income in a year. We have the least progressive tax system in the industrial world. We're the only industrial democracy without a universal health care system, which also keeps people poor. When our students are compared with other students, we're generally at the bottom in math and science and so on. There's a lot of indicators that say that we're really a society in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the guns too.
Yeah. The other societies are amazed at how readily we allow access to lethal weapons. Yes. Canada has much stricter gun laws than we do. They have 1/4 the murder rate that we do.
I saw.
And they're number two in the world, actually. I mean,
we're really number one.
We're really number one. We're so far out ahead of the rest of them that it's not even a race
we're
anymore.
One.
So we have these we have these strict laws for punishment, but we don't have laws of prevention.
Well, I don't know if you have to have laws of prevention.
You have to have
a just society that.
There isn't such a stratification.
Yeah.
Our prevention would be no weapons. I mean,
that's what I'm talking about.
Ironically, many of the people that scream the loudest about gun laws, and there are a lot of them, if you listen to talk radio ever, and I've tried not to very much, but there's always somebody calling and complaining about the politician trying to take away the guns.
there's such degrees of guns.
Yeah, but many of these people, ironically, are very much in favor of a very strong military, but one of the reasons they use for having guns is so that I can use them against the government if I have to.
Oh boy.
Of course, wouldn't be much of a contest, I don't think.
What an attitude, though.
Yeah, what an attitude. And they're also in favor of very strong crime prevention measures otherwise. So they're in favor of a strong central government or a strong government policing kind of power, whether it's military overseas or policing within the United States, yet they want to have as many guns as they can.
It's a real vigilante mentality, that's what it seems. I just hiked over the mountains in the last week with a group of kids, and as a consequence of that, decided I should probably have a gun with me. Which is very foreign to me, but learn how to use a 38. And
you can take this material with you if you like.
And have a 38 with me, which is just like totally foreign to me, but I felt like it probably would be a good idea. And as a matter of fact, we encountered a mountain lion up there and nothing happened, but I now know how to use a gun. And I was reflecting on this because I have had no formal training. I mean, my dad showed me how to use it, and I got pretty good with it, and I'm fine with it. But here I am, an individual citizen. There's no controls on whether or not I can pick up this gun, whether I know how to use it well. I mean, I was individually responsible about it, but I could have just been very irresponsible about it. And there was this great political cartoon I saw in the newspaper last year that really brought this home to me and made me think about it again. That had four pictures. One was a car, one was a person with a fishing pole, one was a dog, and one was a gun. Mm-hmm. And the caption was, which of these may you use without a license? Or may you own without a license? And the answer, of course, was the gun. Mm-hmm. But you have to license your dog, and you have to have a fishing license, and you have to have a license to drive a car. And I looked at that political cartoon and I thought, my God, this is true. And then as I was learning to use this gun, I thought, I could just be any idiot picking up this gun and going out into the woods. Mm-hmm. It's very scary.
Why did it help you with the mountain lion?
I could have shot it.
Well, unfortunately, our political leaders,
I mean, I know that.
Even our Lutheran political leaders, Senator Hollings, for example, of South Carolina, who's an ELCA Lutheran, has spoken out pretty forcefully against media violence, but he voted against the Brady Bill, which is kind of a first step. So,
yeah.
I don't know what...
That's really disillusioning.
I'd like to read something, and I hope it's not prejudging the OJ case, but it's a little article that I clipped. Chaplain offers prayer for OJ, and I found this very troubling. A prayer for O.J. Simpson has issued from the floor of the Senate, where the chamber's chaplain has asked for comfort for the fallen football personality and those who have admired him. We pray for O.J. Simpson, the Reverend Richard Halverson said Thursday during his daily prayer, which opens each Senate session. Whether he is innocent or guilty rests with our system of justice, but our hearts go out to him in his profound loss. Halverson said our nation has been traumatized by the fall of a great hero. Whatever the circumstances, he has got to be hurting deeply, Halverson said. As the wheels of justice slowly grind, may he be comforted by the sense of the presence of the God who loves him. Halverson, who asked for also asked for consolation, kind of as an afterthought here, it looks like, for the unnumbered who have been disillusioned by the fall of their idol. And then in the last petition here, he says, he added, we ask too for your comfort and consolation to the victims and their families. Kind of as an afterthought. But kind of a confusion here on the part of and Billy Graham, of course, called O.J. in jail, I think a couple of days after O.J. was jailed and offered consolation. But did he call the parents of Nicole Simpson? Did he call the parents of Ronald Goldman?
I bet he did. Knowing Billy Graham, I bet he did, but do you think he gets media coverage?
Well, he can issue his press release if he wants to indicate
that's
that he was even-handed about it. The perception is, and perception is oftentimes more important than reality,
right,
is that he called O.J. Simpson, and he didn't call the others. But
you know, I will have to say I don't have too much trouble with that prayer because you do see O.J. Simpson, and he does look like a very hurting young man and does need our prayers. I guess the trouble I have with that is the use of the word hero.
Yeah.
He really isn't a hero. I think you're just...
And the comes the total...
The total focus
on O.J.
Yeah. I mean, look at our nation and all the problems we've got, and what are they zeroing in on? One individual out of all of the people in this country and all the dilemmas that are happening in the world?
Right.
I mean, that's some rare.
But those things are so big, they're too hard.
Well, we're kind of drawing to the close of the hour. If I think we have a couple more minutes. If you would like to discuss any of these other things, I'll be around this afternoon.
Well,
and
you talked about the fact that, I said, since we have such stringent laws for after the fact. After the crime's taking place, but not preventing crime, and this is something that we have a more just society. So how do we come about this more just society? I mean, I know you don't...
Well, economic justice, I think, is the basic thing.
Economic justice.
So much of what prevents that is the same thing as the gun control issue, is our fierce hanging on to individual freedoms, which is what this country is built on. And that's what I hear all the time about equality of economics or about gun control, is that you can't do that to me. That's my individual freedom. You know, I worked hard, I can have this money. Or I can have a gun if I want it. And that's what seems to get in the way. It's almost like our legislature, like our government stumble over the issue of taking away individual freedoms for the better of the society. I think that's one of the basic underpinnings of the problem.
There are truly entrepreneurs, I guess, who have made their money kind of independently of any help, even though they probably, you know, drove on the highways and took part in the infrastructure that was built up over a couple of hundred years and are part of the society.
And they provide jobs for people, and right. I don't think we should discount people who have ambition and who want to
make it.
Because I think at the root of this high-low economic difference that we have within our country is a lack of those good middle-line jobs. Mm-hmm. I just don't think that you have desperate people.